Hello, I'm Amber Athey, the Spectator's Washington editor, and I'm here to encourage you to subscribe to the Spectator's American edition. If you visit spectator.us/subscribe, you can get our print and digital edition for just $7.99 a month. This means you get unlimited access to our amazing website, and we'll send you a beautiful 80-page monthly magazine. You'll also have access to our mobile app. Subscribe now at spectator.us/subscribe. You won't regret it.
Hello, I'm Dominic Green. I'm deputy editor of The Spectator's World Edition, and welcome to this episode of The Green Room, our weekly podcast on books, arts, and all the other things that make life worth living. This week, my guest is Sohrab Amari. He's the opinion page editor of the New York Post. He's also the author of The Unbroken Thread, Discovering the Wisdom of Tradition in an Age of Chaos. And it's the subject of Daniel McCarthy's lead review in the latest issue of our World Edition. Sohrab Amari, welcome to The Green Room.
Thank you for having me, Dominic.
Now, your new book, The Unbroken Thread, which is the lead review in the new edition of Spectator, June's edition, is subtitled Discovering the Wisdom of Tradition in an Age of Chaos. And it made me wonder, is this also merely an age of change, which is how John Stuart Mill, the great liberal thinker of the 19th century, described his era? Or is there something uniquely chaotic to our age?
Well, if I were to try to put the subtitle in a way that's more precise and gets at what I'm really trying to get at, but wouldn't be helpful to the cause of selling books, here's how I would put it. We actually live in an age of intense discipline. We are more regulated at a minute level than ever in terms of what we can say online. Now with the COVID restrictions, whether we can move, whom we can socialize with, and so forth. So we are regulated, we are disciplined, but I would argue that the ends to which we are disciplined are actually disordered. They don't make us truly free, and they don't make us fully human, uphold our true dignity as who we really are as rational animals. So that's what I'm trying to get at with chaos. But as I said, you know, you gotta have a more terse subtitle than that, hence chaos.
Now, you are somebody who could be said to have lived the dream of the liberal autonomous individual, as you describe yourself. What made you then want to look towards an alternative source of strength, the wisdom of tradition, as you call it?
Yeah, I mean, I in my 20s, when I was single and childless, I never thought about things in this way. I was, as you said, I was like the perfect liberal subject in the sense that, first of all, it's liberalism's barrier-dissolving impulses that had brought me to the West as an immigrant. And then I'm, you know, in my 20s, I'm experimenting with ideologies, experimenting with lifestyles, working as a journalist in Europe, traveling here and there, feeling unencumbered and thinking that this is freedom, that just precisely the freedom to choose from the widest range of options, to feel unrestricted and maximally so. But then things changed. I became a Christian at age 31. I converted to Roman Catholicism at the London Oratory. And then more important for this book, I became a father, and my son's name is Maximilian. He was 2 when I started writing the book, and now he's 4. I had very serious anxieties about the kind of man that our culture would chisel out of him. And I had in mind especially the fact that, you know, his namesake is Saint Maximilian Kolbe, who was this Franciscan friar who, to put the story briefly, who laid down his life for a stranger at Auschwitz. He was a Polish Franciscan friar who is a martyr of the church. And I thought about, you know, the vision of life, the submission to authority, the religious kind of convictions that had sustained and made possible this great act of sacrifice that St. Maximilian Kolbe had made. And then I imagined my own son, if left up to the devices of our own culture, the distance between the two was alarmingly vast. You know, and in the book, I tell the full story of Maximilian Kolbe, and then I imagine my own son. You know, he's the same age as when his patron saint laid down his life for strangers at Auschwitz, and it's not like he's living an absolute dissolute life, but he's just one of our typical elites, where he just looks to material gratification, getting ahead, hooking up, and that's all he looks for in life. And that troubled me, the fact that it seemed like our culture wants to deform him in that way, if left up to its own devices. So I had to critique our contemporary arrangements. But how do I do that? Not to just sort of bang on and say, well, this is how you should live, but to write a book of questions. And this book has 12 fundamental questions that I argue our contemporary ideology doesn't pay attention to or imagines have been answered by science and technology, when in fact they're still pertinent to a good life, to a full human life. And I'm not a theologian, I'm not a philosopher, so instead of, you know, propounding my own ideas, as a storyteller, I explored each question through the life of one great thinker, through their thought and biography.
Well, you may not be a philosopher or a theologian, although I think you are both at times in this, but Daniel McCarthy in his review asks the question, and he is being ironic, we have to hope, when he said, Sir Amari is an ogre sent by Satan to annihilate American freedom. And he, of course, we really think he is joking. I will check this. But how did we get to this, where somebody like yourself, who is defending what in virtually any other time would have been thought of as very straightforward religious conscience and very straightforward way of thinking about life, really, would be so opposed to the ruling ideology of his day?
Yeah, I mean, he's referring to the fact, and it's a wonderful review. I'm so grateful for Daniel for writing it. But he's right. I mean, I'm routinely called a theocrat, a would-be authoritarian, and so forth. And the reason for that is, I think, because liberals sense that their ideology is under challenge. It's under threat. It's under threat from voters on both sides of the Atlantic who are increasingly dissatisfied with the global liberal consensus. And intellectually, it's under threat from, well, frankly, kind of writers and intellectuals like myself who are saying, look, this ideology does not satisfy lots of important human needs, the need for order, the need for continuity, the need for a society that can develop people who seek more than just their own self-maximization. And so that they react very vehemently to that, liberals have a very tend to have, not all of them, but the typical kind of liberal writer thinker has a very narrow horizon, where a historical horizon, where it's either liberalism or just a land of horrors. And that means lots of the past is a land of horrors as well. No one was rational before, you know, the late 18th, early 19th century, just one long string of religious wars and persecutions. That's the liberal reflex, is as soon as a sort of ideological or intellectual challenger comes, to try to put it in a box and say, that's theocracy. And I would argue that that's what Daniel is referring to in terms of my reception as a writer.
Now, that idea that there is only liberalism or the land of horrors, it does bear a striking resemblance to earlier forms of extreme thinking, such as Manichaeanism or Gnosticism. And it's interesting that along with the figures you might well expect to find in a book like this, people like Augustine and Confucius and Seneca, C.S. Lewis, there is also somebody like Hans Jonas, who was a scholar of Gnosticism. And there were a group of scholars, in fact, in the early 20th century, who were very much aware of the ways in which liberalism, in replacing the religious-centered life, had actually come to act like religion in its less tolerant moments. Do you think one of the difficulties now in making this case is convincing liberals that there actually is this religious or quasi-religious aspect to their thinking?
Right, and that seems like it's an uphill battle to do that. I have a friend, he's a prominent liberal scholar at a very kind of prestigious university. He's open-minded enough, liberal in the kind of sense of liberality, that he maintains a dialogue with me, even though we vehemently disagree. But he really, I mean, I got to press him, and he really views, you know, the Aristotelian tradition or Plato as, and then you have like St. Thomas, all of it, anything that's basically not modern, as a source of repression that was mercifully overcome. On the other hand, I mean, with this kind of attitude taken to practice or taken to its logical conclusion, gives rise to the kind of iconoclasm that we saw over the last year. Even liberalism's own earlier avatars become suspect because not everyone is perfectly liberal. Not everyone is perfectly liberated in every dimension. And so liberals have to look at their own, even recent history, as problematic. And so even heroes like Churchill or Abraham Lincoln now have to be toppled because they didn't perfectly match up to the ideal of liberation. I think if you describe it that way, I would hope some liberal readers would see how that has a dimension that's precisely the opposite of what they claim to cherish, that it's the fanatical and zealous and the worst of, let's say, pre-modern religion.
Isn't the one of the big sticking points that you believe, and I think you make a very good case for it too, that privacy does not mean you are free from the social obligations or the obligations of conscience and so on, that merely entertaining yourself in private and paying your taxes or doing whatever else is required to satisfy the public realm, this isn't enough? And doesn't that argument go against the great consolation prize of modern life, which is libertinism, really, doing whatever you like in private?
Yeah, I mean, look, in this book, I, as you kind of hinted, I profile figures who are in some ways vastly different. There are the ones you would expect, you know, Aquinas and C.S. Lewis and Solzhenitsyn and Newman. But there are also others that are kind of, they don't quite sit as easily, like Hans Jonas or even the radical feminist thinker, Andrea Dworkin. And I recognize that this makes it not a book of tradition, but a book of traditions, plural. And I allow them to sit in their tensions. I mean, I don't try to suggest that tradition speaks with one voice in a kind of univocal, resounding way. Nevertheless, if I were to draw one thread that runs through all the figures that are profiled in this book and through the ideas profiled in this book, it is this, that precisely the kind of life you describe, that I am free insofar as I just can do what I want in private and I'm unrestricted, is actually, paradoxically, is not a free life. That in fact, we become prisons of our own appetites, prisons of our own acquisitiveness, and prisons of our own baser sides. And again, paradoxically, what appeared in traditional religion as restrictive, as limiting us, was liberating us, in fact, that it in fact is a source of liberation. So to give a concrete example, with a chapter on Abraham Joshua Heschel, we treat the Sabbath this way. What is the point of the Jewish Sabbath? On surface, it looks like an annoying restriction. From sundown to sundown, you know, you can't work. Heschel himself, who was a writer, couldn't write because he had to annotate his scripture books with paper clips and napkins because he was barred from writing by the Sabbath. So it looks like an imposition. Nevertheless, Heschel argues, in fact, it's a source of interior liberty, that by spending one day with contemplative things, with God, with family, with good books, you shut off for just a little bit. You shut off that acquisitiveness, the clamor, the gossip, the constant drive for profit and prosperity that defines the rest of our lives. And in that way, you create a kind of detachment for yourself and you preserve a space for interior things. So that's just one example. And there are many others in the book where you see something that at first appears as a source of oppression, of restriction, of limits, but in fact, it's helping you liberate yourself. And the demolition of those barriers, again, paradoxically, imprisons you.
Would you say that the greatest threat now to that kind of interior liberty comes from social media companies rather than from people doing whatever they like? It's actually the increasingly intrusive presence of a small number of very powerful tech companies in their thoughts and in their inner lives, and to turn, as it were, from the sacred to the profane. By day, you're the opinion editor at the New York Post, and when the Post ran the story of Hunter Biden's laptop, you were effectively cast in the position of those statues which have to be overturned, or those figures which must be airbrushed out of history, you know, like that famous shot of Stalin and his accomplices, which gets, you know, the crowd thins out over time. When that happened, what did you think?
Well, I mean, there are two points in what you raised, and it's a very good question. The first is the invasion of social media into our interior life, and I'm just as much as a subject of this as anyone, in the sense that I'm addicted to Twitter, I'm addicted to Facebook. and they are an enemy of interiority, and they are designed to be this way. In other words, that these companies hire neurologists who know precisely how to addict people to the infinite scroll, where you just never stop, you just keep refreshing. And it's very depressing, and something I personally, you know, it's not like I've completely overcome that at all. So that's one set of issues. The other set is precisely that these companies not only addict us using our kind of neurological defects or neurological weaknesses, but also increasingly try to shape what we can say, kind of news we can share, and what we can think, really. And we saw that in a very naked, very galling and just astonishing way with the censorship of the New York Post, America's oldest continuously published daily newspaper, a perfectly legitimate story that remains undisputed in its core facts, but you couldn't share it, and you couldn't even, not only could you not share it on Twitter for a while in your public page, but Twitter would bar you from sharing it in direct messages privately, which is the kind of really sinister aspect of this. But again, you see how, and this kind of follows on from the dynamic I mentioned, where we gave maximal economic liberty to these kind of private actors, and a certain kind of conservative said, ah, that's freedom. It's not government authority has been, you know, weakened thanks to social media. But it turns out that privately owned companies can be just as repressive, and they can be used just as more effectively than kind of traditional censorship mechanisms. And again, you see how the dream of maximal private power as a defense against tyranny paradoxically becomes a source of tyranny.
There is a recurring strain of criticism in American history of this kind, but very often it's come from immigrants who can see it perhaps more sharply because they haven't grown up in it. And one of those figures in the book is, of course, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who was one of the great defenders of the individual conscience in the age of 20th century totalitarianism. Do you think that being an immigrant has clarified this for you in a way, that you were already going your own way and already obliged to look at things freshly and from the outside?
Well, I mean, I don't want to compare myself to Solzhenitsyn as a writer.
That much.
You know, it's certainly true that in his case, he obviously had survived the gulag and written about it, and it helped, in fact, awaken the West conscience to what was happening under totalitarianism. So he was certainly no fan of brutal, you know, regimes with lacking rule of law. On the other hand, when he came to the West, he famously or infamously gave a commencement speech at Harvard in 1978. And what he wrote in his diary was, "I was expected to sing the immigrant's ode to the great Atlantic fortress of liberty," meaning to just pray. Now that I've come from behind the Iron Curtain, I'm going to praise everything in the West. But in fact, he didn't do that. In fact, the commencement speech he gave was a pretty withering criticism of the West as it was. And he argued that the Western concept of freedom had reduced freedom to a bare legalism, and that we had failed to distinguish what the kind of classical tradition did, the difference between freedom for good and freedom for evil. And then in the most shocking or scandalous part of the speech, he said, "If I were asked whether I would recommend your society, such as it exists now, for the transformation of mine," meaning Russia under the Soviet Union, "I would have to decline your offer." And so obviously, immediately, Solzhenitsyn's reception in the West shifted. He went from being a celebrated hero and a brave heart of a writer and dissident to being framed by the Western press as a kooky mystic, a reactionary, an autocrat, a theocrat, and all the rest. But I do think the reason he was able to see the problem with both sides, meaning the both sides of the Iron Curtain, was having lived under both. You see, if you live under totalitarian regimes, you immediately notice, you know, that the absence of the rule of law, and how painful that is. But you come to the West and you see how the kind of the excesses of rights, excesses of individual liberty, also are less than worthy of man, as he would say.
Yeah, I think somewhere de Tocqueville made a similar observation about in American life, what begins as a moral problem ends up in court as a legal one, and that's the way it's done. I don't often put them in the same sentence, but you know, Solzhenitsyn being seen as sort of freakish outlier and a heretic, and yet the election of Donald Trump in 2016 was one of those series of events you referred to that made it clear that larger and larger numbers of people in the free societies of the West no longer believed in the logic of liberalism as practiced. Do you think that there is also a danger, though, as we see, say, trust in free markets collapsing and a high-handed attitude and a very partisan attitude taken towards free speech, that the foundation of those things, the freedom of conscience, is also going to be under more and more threat in the near future? Because one of those historical facts, which I think liberals have more trouble perhaps acknowledging than most, is that our ideas of free speech originated as the freedom of religious conscience. The freedom of the inner life is what actually produced all those Enlightenment laws about being able to speak publicly. Do you see that threat as worsening as liberalism becomes more rigid and more threatened?
Yeah, I mean, here's the way I see it. You mentioned, let me go to the economic realm since you mentioned it first. Obviously, I don't want to live under socialism. I mean, I don't want to live in a society in which the state owns all goods. But my fear is that if liberal economies can't find some way of addressing the issues of economic justice, the fact that for two, three generations, capital has done extremely well, and especially for people on the lower scale, working class people, the prospects have gotten dimmer. There's no career mobility, no sense of class mobility. And, you know, that's how you, the excesses of liberalism could invite a real socialism to enter the scene again. And you do see that with what's happening with not just the Democratic Party, but center-left parties across the West as well. And then, you know, with conscience issues, absolutely. What I worry about is that liberalism, having used, I think, a distorted idea of conscience, meaning conscience as whatever, the right of me to think whatever I want to think, over against oppressive religious or other institutional authorities, having used that idea of conscience to win for itself its triumph as an ideology, has now gotten to the point where it no longer needs to appeal to conscience. It really has its own substantive commitments. So, for example, the idea of the total liberation of man from his body, or the overcoming the body, which you see in transgenderism, it's achieved that, and it no longer is interested in the dissent of religious minorities or religious dissidents who insist on the older definition of sex being a bodily phenomenon. It no longer needs that, and so it's perfectly willing to be an illiberal liberalism, right? The outcome is liberal, and if you don't like it, then then you're going to be silenced in the public square. So it's a kind of liberalism by fiat, liberalism by the force of corporate power. This is all very terrifying.
I think it's inarguable that this kind of stuff, which used to be called, you know, the great books, was the core of liberal education until, you know, very recently. And by very recently, I don't mean the 1850s. I mean 15 years ago, 20 years ago. To the reader who picks up this book and discovers, you know, this thread. And as Daniel says in his review, you know, a generation has been robbed of their spiritual patrimony. In the way they've been educated, and that you are returning that connection to them. How would you like your readers to proceed from there?
Well, that's a good question. I'm asked often, and the short answer is, I don't know, but I have great faith in the power of small intellectual elites, and that young writers and thinkers whom I know sense that there's something very dissatisfying with the present, that it in some ways resembles a dystopia. It really has the feel where we have some of the best dystopian fictions you can imagine in the past few years, Blade Runner 2049 or what have you. And for some reason, we see how we're headed that way, and yet we can't seem to pull ourselves back. And so I think that sense of urgency could awaken a younger generation to recovering this older tradition, which I think is the basis of what's best about the West. And so I hope this book contributes in some way to that process of recovery. It's a work of high vulgarization, as the French say. That is, you will get a pretty good primer into what John Henry Newman's life was like and how he distinguished modern versus pre-modern conscience, or you will get a pretty decent introduction to Hans Jonas and the modern kind of philosophical study of ancient Gnosticism and so forth. So it's informed by scholarship, but it's not a scholarly work, and so it potentially could find a curious audience. I mean, not of curious people, not like it, they're curious as in the English sense, they're weird. Yeah,
a bunch of freaks and weirdos will definitely enjoy reading this book. No, it reminds me. You are as the the toppled statue would say, giving the tools so people can finish the job or at least pursue it in their own ways. And I was reminded by this of Joseph Soloveitchik, a rabbi of modern Orthodoxy, who in many ways I think was working in similar lines. He made an observation, and he was an immigrant too, incidentally, and he said, you can't tell Americans what to do, but you can teach them anything. And I think The Unbroken Thread is precisely that kind of book, in that you are giving people the materials for their own personal development in their own way. And I think that the purpose of ideas and debate and argument can never be higher than that. So, Saurabh Murray, thank you.
Thank you, Dominic.
And you've been listening to me, Dominic Green, casting the pod with him, Saurabh Murray, in the Green Room. Join us next week for more on books, arts, and everything else that makes life worth living. You can find us on iTunes under The Spectator. Thank you for listening.